Hello, and welcome back to the Cambridge American History Seminar podcast, where this week, Richard Blackett, the Andrew Jackson Professor of History at Vanderbilt University, will be talking about the life of Samuel Ringold Ward, a prominent but now relatively unknown abolitionist compared to his contemporaries such as Frederick Douglass. Ward led a fascinating life that took him from the US to Canada, Liberia, and Jamaica. Professor Blackett will be joined by Fergus, our regular co-host, and Shay Hendry, a PhD candidate and historian of the Loyalist diaspora in the post-revolutionary world. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy the episode.
So, Richard, hi. Our first question, who was Samuel Ringold Ward?
Ward was he was born enslaved on the eastern shore of Maryland in 1817. And he and his parents escaped when he was younger than 3 years old. So Ward really didn't know anything about slavery. He hadn't experienced it personally, but his parents did. In fact, Ward didn't find out he was enslaved until he was 24. His mother didn't tell him, his mother told his wife, who then told Ward, oh, by the way, you were born a slave. But I suspect he knew what the situation was. But he became, in the years after their escape and after they moved to New York City, they stayed for a while. They lived for a while among a heavily Quaker area of southern New Jersey after they escaped. Until slave catchers came looking for members of the extended family. And then they decided to move, to put some distance between themselves and slavery, and move to New York City, where Ward attended what was known as the African Free School, that produced some of the great leaders, black leaders of 19th century America. So that's where he was educated, and he supplemented that by private tutoring and also by just educating himself about things. So that is Ward's background before he emerges as a main figure in the struggle against slavery.
So this figure has long been obscured from scholarly view, in part because of the challenge of compiling useful primary source evidence. How do you begin that process in order to get a project like this off the ground in the first place?
I wrote a book of biographical essays way back in the night. It was published 1986, a long time ago, of 19th century African American figures, and I had hoped to include Ward. Because I first came across Ward when I was doing research on my first book, which looks at black Americans who came to Britain in the antebellum period to agitate against slavery in the hope of winning British support for emancipation. And Ward was one of those figures that came into view, particularly when he visited in the 1850s. So I thought I would include him, but there were so many gaps in his life that I decided to drop it, partly because also the book was already much too long anyway. You should only write one doorstopper in your life if you're going to write doorstoppers. So I dropped Ward, and then about 3 years ago, Yale Press started this series called Black Lives that looks at black figures generally in the United States and other parts of the world. And I was asked if I would do one of the books. And I said, yeah, why don't I try and revisit Ward? And that's where it came about. And by that time, between when I was first thought of writing about him back in the 1980s and more recently, there had been significant breakthroughs in the compilation of material on African Americans in this period. So I was able to draw on some of that, as well as supplemented with what the things that were already in my folders sitting in drawers, lots of pieces of paper. So that's how I stitched the story together, but there were still lots of gaps remained that I was never able to fill. But and biographers hate gaps. You know, you want to be fully in command of the material of your subject, but and as a historian, an old-fashioned historian, I assume, who I cannot reach beyond my evidence, I found myself in a quandary at times, trying to make sense of his life. But there was enough there so that I could do it and feel that I had captured his life sufficiently to proceed with it.
So then I guess kind of building upon your answer, I would love to hear more of your thoughts about kind of using biography, or how we should think about biography in the context of history writing, or how kind of an individual life can illuminate larger themes, or what kind of purpose you see it serving.
Yeah. Biography is helpful in the sense that it gives you an opportunity to dive deep into a life. And from that deep dive, ever so often you have to look up from the subject and say, well, what is he telling us about the times in which he lives, he or she, or what were they doing to affect, particularly figures like Ward, who are struggling against a system, an oppressive system in which they are living. How does this help us to illuminate or shed some light on the times in which he lived? So we can step back from Ward and look at his participation in the abolitionist movement writ large, as well as some of the political struggles that were taking place in mid-19th century America. And of course, Ward then comes to Britain in the 1850s, so what was happening there? So it gives you an opportunity to reach beyond the individual's life to find some meaning about what it is he or she is trying to do. And I think that's all good biographers like. That's all biographers like to do. But you can never lose sight of the subject yourself. He or she must guide what it is that you're doing, so that you begin to talk like Ward and walk like Ward, and I can't look like Ward, but you begin to get a feel for the person and for the times in which he or she lived, and that's what makes it important.
So then to start getting into some more of the specifics on Ward himself, we notice that your book opens with kind of the enthusiastic comments from Frederick Douglass about Ward, and as someone who I think will be quite familiar to people as kind of an abolitionist figure, what do we know about their relationship? How significant should we read into kind of his relationship to other of these key figures?
Yeah, Douglass makes this comment as he is writing his big book on his life and the struggle. So it comes, Douglass is making this comment about Ward from the vantage point of the 1890s, looking back over five, six decades in which they were working together to undermine slavery and eliminate sort of racial discrimination. And it's, for Douglass, it's a sense of loss, because Ward abandons America, he leaves America, because he put America in a very short reign. Anytime it did something crazy as far as he was concerned, personally, he thought about leaving. And Douglass, when Ward was in Britain in the 1850s, Douglass kept saying to him, Sam, come back. We need you in this struggle. Don't stay too long. And he never comes back. He goes to Jamaica. But the two of them had a real effective working relationships. It never, Ward was not an individual who let things pass. He didn't take fools gladly, but with Douglas, he never allowed any differences they had to get out of hand. It never became sort of a personal antagonistic relation. Although he teased Douglas numerous times about the fact that Douglas's father is white and a slaveholder. And Ward was very proud of that he was black. And in fact, anytime you see a description of Ward anywhere, a positive description of Ward, a number of things emerge out of that description. One, how big he is. He's a big man. He's well over 6 foot in mid-19th century, that is a big man. He is big physically, not just tall. He joked that he was 16 stone at one time. That's a lot of weight. Even for Americans who don't know what a stone is. And he was very black. And the descriptions of him, and he was an orator of immense power, made Douglas, who was reputed to most probably be one of the great orators of 19th century America, Douglas thought he was the best, that Ward was much superior to all of them. And there are other descriptions of Ward. James McEwen said he was the best man on his feet, spontaneous. He had this biting wit. He could bring audiences to their feet, make them laugh at times when they should be depressed. So he and Douglas worked very effectively, although they were both editors of newspapers, competing newspapers, by the way. Whatever tensions existed between them, it was always under control. That is not the same. We can't say the same thing about Ward and some of his other contemporaries. He could be savage in his criticism of people, but not with Douglas. Not with Douglas, nor with Douglas with him. So it was an interesting relationship. And in many times, they operated in tandem, a kind of dog and pony show when dealing with some of the great racists in New York City. And effectively putting them out. And that tandem of Ward and Douglas became a sort of prominent feature of sort of mid-19th century abolitionist agitation. So if Douglas thinks that you're one of the great orators of the time, you have to say, from where we sit looking back, and when you read his speeches, you can imagine it has... People talk of standing outside hall rooms and listening in to Ward lecturing and hearing only at times when there are very serious points being made, hearing people laughing. So he had that ability also to bring audiences to their feet with some of the things that he said. So, and he had that wonderful 19th century skill, which was to bring in into his ordinary lectures classical imagery and references to things that, you know, if you're not a religiously inclined person, as I am not, I have to call my wife and say, can I borrow your Bible? I know you have one somewhere. So I could read up what the hell is being said in Ecclesiastes 1 or what. I have no idea what this is. I mean, I was raised a Catholic, and Catholics don't read the Bible, you know. So I had no idea what was going on. But he had that wonderful ability to use that kind of both classical references and religious imagery to bring his point out, which is, I suppose, some of the hallmarks of good orators. I don't think he ever prepared his speeches. I see no evidence of that. The only place I have seen his speeches is if they're copied in newspapers, But I have found none. I have found none of his notes on his speeches or anything like that. So it's not that he didn't sit home and prepare a speech because he was going to some meeting. I think that's why people thought he was so effective. He seemed to just get up and do it.
Not recorded, but
this is at the period when people shorthand. Journalists became perfected shorthand and became very, very efficient in transcribing speeches and then going back to the office, I suppose, and then putting it into English. So that is how we know what he was saying. But there are no notes of his anywhere that says he sat down and even a sermon, which is what typical ministers do. I have not found anything like that. So.
You mentioned Ward's internationalism, which we're going to come back to in a moment, but we're wondering more about some of Ward's character and outlook and personality and what kind of sense you get from this in your work.
When you say character and personality.
Yeah, like the life and personality of the man. What does the biography help illustrate here?
Well, one of the things that comes out very quickly is that Ward, Ward didn't particularly in matters political, as it dealt with slavery, for instance. Ward could not understand how there were black people, particularly those in New York State, who would vote for parties in which there were slaveholders. So he couldn't understand why they would vote for the Whig Party or the Democratic Party, because there were slaveholders in both of those parties. And he could not stomach the fact that they continued to do it in spite of his efforts to show them the right way. And that frustrated him no end. And it is at points like that that we see him at his most acerbic and his most brutal in his criticism of people. He did not pull punches on these scores. He would allow other people, and when he went to Jamaica, he did the same thing. He just could not abide people who knew better and yet continued to act in ways that seemed to violate, to go against their own best interests as well as the interests of the race, as he saw it. So in that sense, that's one of his, you could call that a personality trait. And it's one of those that I try to explore a little bit of in the book without getting into too much psychological stuff, because that's not my area of expertise. I don't pretend to understand why people always act the way they do. But Ward left us enough evidence that if he said to you, listen, you're doing the wrong thing and you continue to do the wrong thing, he would tell you publicly that you're doing the wrong thing in ways that were not always very nice.
Maybe that's an interesting kind of lead-in to talking about his decision later in life to leave the U.S. permanently. And I guess my question would be, maybe there's a series of questions, so feel free to answer what jumps out at you. But is that something that could then tell us about his ideas of citizenship or nationality in any particular way? Or should we think about Ward as an exile in that period of his life? And I guess even in kind of placing him within the history of international abolitionist thought, how helpful is it to think about him as a specifically American abolitionist?
Well, one of the things that I quickly came to realize is that once you leave America, you fall off the pages of American history. So it's hard to place Ward in that sense. But Ward, on a number of occasions, when he felt offended by America's racism, he thought of leaving very seriously. He did it in 1838 when his tutor, when he and his tutor were putting together a list of people to start a literary society in upstate New York. And when the list came out, his tutor did not include him. Because he thought if he included a black person, then folks would not join the literary society. And that hurt Ward to the core. That seemed to violate all that he stood for. And at that point, he wrote making inquiries about migrating to Trinidad because emancipation had just been kicked in 1838 at the end of the apprenticeship scheme. And there were efforts being made to recruit black Americans to go to Trinidad. Why Ward would want to do that, I do not know, because he had no skills as an agricultural laborer. He would have perished cutting cane in anywhere in the Caribbean. I have no doubt about that, in spite of his size and his strength. So that was one. He showed, and again in 1842, when the Supreme Court came down with a decision that he thought reinforced the 1793 Fugitive Slave Law, he thought again of leaving. And then, of course, once the Fugitive Slave Law, the new Fugitive Slave Law was passed in 1850, and he participated in a rescue of a fugitive slave in Syracuse, he became vulnerable to being caught as a fugitive slave himself. But even before the passage of this fugitive slave, there were signs that he had soured and staying in America, because whatever Ward did, how much he worked and how much he labored and how much he prepared himself, he was never, the society did not accept him in the ways that society accepts people of his brilliance. Mm-hmm. And his accomplishments. And he had again, I think, decided that it was time. It just simply was not the place for him. And when he moves to Canada in 1851, in his autobiography, he writes to Douglas and he says to Douglas, "Take it, it's yours. It's a crazy country. I will have nothing to do with it anymore." Not that he could sever himself that clearly, but it was clear to him the way he had written it that America and all its madness was for people like Douglas and not for him. He just wouldn't do it. So that's his first exile, really, to go to Canada, and then he comes to Britain as an agent of the Canadian Anti-Slavery Society. And at the end of that agency, rather than the return to Canada, he goes to Jamaica. Partly because Ward was always in debt. Whatever he did, he could not make enough money to just keep himself and his family. His newspaper that he ran very successfully for a long time was always in the red. People took out subscriptions and wouldn't send in their subscription. And he pleads with people. He says, "Please, folks, you promised to take out a subscription and you're not sending me the money." And he ends one plea to his subscribers who are not subscribing. He says, "It's hard." And I found that so telling, and it's clear that by this time, Ward had begun to think very seriously that there was nothing for him in the United States. And as I said, he ended up almost in debtor's prison. I mean, he was brought before court. So it was a sense that America, in spite of all that he did, in spite of all his accomplishments, America could not provide him with the things that it would provide any of its white citizens in a similar situation. Mm-hmm. And that really gnawed at his soul. And I think to some extent made him even more angry at people who he thought were simply not doing what they should do to overthrow the system. So, I think in that sense, he's a man that is looking for another opportunity outside of the United States. Mm-hmm. I think he would have returned to Canada if he hadn't gotten himself in trouble with money again and debt. Mm-hmm. So Jamaica provides an option. He had land was given him by a Quaker from Chelmsford in Essex who owned land in Jamaica. But, you know, Ward wasn't into agriculture. So I don't even think he ever got his... But the point is he has a great nostalgia for it. Mm-hmm. He talks very lovingly of his father showing him how to plant and to reap and to... a garden, and he always talks of returning to his garden when things got rough. But that's about it's almost nostalgia that is driving that, I don't think.
So more than on some of these racial paradoxes, we know that Ward was the pastor of a predominantly white congregation in upstate New York. How might that reshape our understanding of his abolition work and its sense of audience?
He was the pastor of two white congregations, not predominantly. The only black members of the congregation were his family. Wow. And so that the first congregation in South Butler in upstate, way north upstate New York, almost in Canada, was an experiment that Ward thought... would be a great opportunity to show to the world that there were people who were willing to reach across the racial divide. But he knew full well that the country was looking at him and them to see if they would fail. And that must have been a terrible burden to carry with you. And the congregation, the first congregation in South Butler was a small one. And, again, even there, he had to beg to survive. The church is a small congregation. He couldn't afford to pay him even enough for firewood, I would think, for to see him through the winter in upstate New York. So it's, again, one of those situations that he had to bring in money from other organizations. He had to go on lecture tours to raise money, and that was always what he spent an enormous amount of time on the road, both as a pastor, as well as a minister, as well as a lecturer for the anti-slavery societies, as well as raising money for his newspapers later on. And it was never enough money to keep the wolves from the door. It's as simple as that. So it's a kind of... I thought about it, you know, what does it mean to be committed to... What is the price the individual pays for challenging America? What price does the individual, in terms of his old psychological state of mind, but also of just surviving and existing, that challenges a system. And I look back at some of the folks who were struggling in the civil rights movement in the more modern period of time. They all paid a terrible price, from what happened to Martin Luther King to Malcolm X to Bayard Rustin. You go through it, the list is endless. Stokely Carmichael. Many of them end up either dead or in exile or having to suffer enormous hardship by attacking the system. And I think to some extent Ward was one of the early victims of that, and he took the option of leaving. Others didn't, but he did. I look back on some of the people that I wrote about, some of those early biographical essays. Pennington, who was a strong advocate of temperance, ended up drinking, which is one of those great ironies, you know. And then having to explain to friends and acquaintances, why are you doing this? You're violating all the... the friends and acquaintances are not sympathetic to the kind of pressures that people feel criticizing the system. So I think there's that personal cost that one has to pay, and Ward paid it. And as a result, I think that's one of the reasons that we know so little about him, partly because he left the country and he dies in obscurity. So, yes, there's a price to pay.
And we know he published his autobiography in Britain in 1855, I believe, and maybe there's financial implications to that decision.
He made no money in that.
Oh, okay.
He made no money in that because he was gone. He handed the manuscript to his publisher and he left the country for Jamaica, and without telling people where he was going. But for you folks who are most probably in the throes of writing theses and dissertations and all that kind of stuff, think about this. Ward sat in a hotel room and wrote a 400-page book in 4 months without a single scrap of notes. He did it all from memory. And I was very skeptical about that because, after all, I couldn't write 400 pages locked up in a room in 4 months. And I thought something else is going on here. He must have had notes with him. But then I thought he duplicated or replicated a speech that he gave when he helped free the fugitive slave in Syracuse. Mm-hmm. And part of the speech is in the autobiography. And I have a copy of the speech from a newspaper. So I went back and looked at it and looked at the autobiography, and they're almost identical, which tells me something. The man had a power of recall that is, as the kids would say, awesome. You know?
Yeah.
Because there's no evidence, because there's also evidence from his contemporaries in England, his supporters, that he was locked up in a room doing this without any notes. So, I mean, we know he wasn't lying. Mm-hmm. But so he has a power of recall and an ability to apply himself that is simply, you know, you have to just tip your head to him. And so when... I don't have graduate students anymore because I've retired, but I wish I could have said to some of them when they started weeping and gnashing in my office about how hard it is, I say, look, Ward did his in 4 months. What are you complaining about? Just go and write the damn thing. You know? he has this wonderful ability to apply himself, to work enormously hard. There are stories of him riding from one lecture to another in upstate New York in an upstate New York winter, which is, you know, in the 19th century is fierce. Writing editorials, and they compared him to Erasmus, the old Dutch divine who used to do crazy stuff like that. But Ward had an amazing ability to apply himself to whatever it is he was doing. And that kind of hard work and dedication never benefited him financially or otherwise. You know, and he tried his hand at other things. He thought of doing the law, he thought of going into medicine, explored it, and then decided that wasn't for him. And he has this wonderful passage in his autobiography that he says to young readers, find something that you like doing and want to do and keep doing it. And it was a kind of autobiographical, because he could never do it. Mm-hmm. He never had the patience, I suppose is one word, to apply himself that way.
Do you have any sense, I guess, in the records talking about his process in writing that autobiography, that he was conscientiously doing it, knowing he was going to Jamaica and seeing a kind of transition point in his abolitionism, or did he have the expectation to continue working at that kind of pace?
No, I think he by that point he knew he was going to go to Jamaica. He had been the guy had given him the land, and he had I don't know at what stage he had borrowed the money from the Englishman who was planning to migrate to Canada, promising to repay him when he got back to Toronto. And the guy says that Ward had some cockamania scheme that he conjured up, that the Englishman would go off on his boat with his family, and Ward would go on a speedier boat and would be in Toronto by the time he had, and it doesn't sound like Ward. I mean, it seems so out of character. But I'm not doubting the man that that Ward conned him out of his money. Well, Ward borrowed the money from him without having the means to repay it. But he was never profligate. There's no evidence that he conned anybody before that. So this seems totally out of character. But I mean, the man provides the evidence, the countless letters that he writes to people trying to recoup his money, if they could only find where Ward is in Jamaica. Nobody can say where he was. And he moves to Jamaica, and he gets himself involved in the politics of Jamaica in this period, which is a very traumatic and nasty business. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, definitely.
No, but he did. I think his plan was to write the autobiography, and mm-hmm. hopefully this would provide him with some money. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it ever did. I don't know if he got an advance, but I doubt they didn't give unknown authors advances in this period. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it ever. There are only three reviews I have found of the autobiography. Because it's not a classical slave narrative in the sort of Douglas mold. It's really a narrative of a free black man, mm-hmm. which is different. I mean, it doesn't have the same kind of appeal, nor doesn't have the same kind of political clout as traditional slave narratives did. So in all of those things, again, worked against him. Mm-hmm. But it is a super piece of work to read, to find out how many things he was doing and who he met, and you know, mm-hmm. and Ward managed to get in a fight. Well, not a fight, but Ward managed to be very critical of Harriet Beecher Stowe. I mean, it takes a lot of gumption to just be critical of old Harriet. You know, she is the lady that changed the face of the world. But Ward was very upset with her in one of her books. Because, again, Ward didn't take slights easily. She wrote her memoir, Sunny Memories, or whatever it was called, of her trip to England with her brother and husband. They worked, and she and Stowe worked together on a number of occasions while they were here. They shared a house together. They went to the Duchess of Sutherland's house for a big soiree to listen to Elizabeth Greenfield, the sort of first black opera singer in this period. And Stowe wrote very movingly of this experience. But in writing it, she didn't say that she entered the building on Ward's arm. And he took that, he he was so offended by that, that she deliberately excluded it so that it would not affect her sales. Because he thought if she had written that she had entered the Duchess of Sutherland's house for the soiree on the arms of this big black man, that people would have said, don't buy the book. I don't know if that's true, but Ward took it very, very personally. And, you know.
So our final question then is, if Ward died in obscurity, how do you conclude this story? How do you begin to fill in the gaps that bring the story to an end?
Well, I just said he died. And then, I mean, if he didn't die in obscurity, I'd still have to say he died. In a sense...
Where does it leave us?
Yes, in a sense, it fits the pattern of his life in which there are gaps that you just can't fill. And many people have tried to find where he disappeared to. And when his autobiography wasn't republished until 1968. And then there was another version that was published 2 years later, in which Vincent Hardin wrote a preface to it. In which he got very poetic about Ward disappearing into the mountains of Jamaica, you know, and you have as a young guy who also disappeared into the mountains of Jamaica. I wasn't going there for what Ward was going for in the 1960s, 100 years later, but it just disappears. He got himself involved on the wrong side of the Moran Bay Rebellion, which is the most consequential political development in Jamaican history until they got independence, I would think, or until the great labor strikes of the 1930s. But he was on the wrong side. A man who had struggled against oppression in America supports the British colonial imperial system. And nobody, that's another thing that may have affected his interest among historians, is that it is hard to explain a man who did what he did in America, turns around and almost goes 180 degrees. But if you read his speeches, you have to come to, I came to a slightly different conclusion. He didn't go 180 degrees and become the mouthpiece of the colonial state. He had a clear vision of what the future held, and he insisted that the future rested with the small man, the landless, and the peasants of Jamaica, and not the estate owners or the merchants of Kingston, Jamaica, but with the little man. And he was just pleading with them, don't do this, don't rebel, because it would backfire. To some extent, he is right, but I think he also supported the governor. It's clear that he supported the governor. And I mean, the governor was recalled and became a big crisis in British politics because, you know, the brutality of the oppression of that rebellion is really one of the dark moments in British colonial history, and there are lots of dark moments. So there's a gap. He ends with a gap. We start with a gap and we end with a gap. It seems to me...
Full circle.
Yes.
Circularity. Well, thank you so much, Richard. That was terrific.
Yes, yeah, thank you.
And that was Professor Richard Blackett, Fergus and Shea. This episode was much delayed in being uploaded, and there will probably be one more until we take a summer break. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you enjoyed.